Thank you all so much for coming. Can everybody in the back here, just somebody nod if you can hear me?
Not that we can see you.
Good. I can't. I don't know that I can see you. Cokie, welcome back to Philadelphia.
Thank you,
not a strange place to you.
Treat to be here.
So, not a lot going on in Washington these days.
No, nothing. Nothing happening.
You know, as from Bill, you can hear from Bill's introduction, you and I have been around a while.
Yeah.
You have covered...
I've been around longer than you.
Yeah, okay, a little. And you've been in Washington. But, I mean, you've seen the Reagan Revolution. You saw Newt Gingrich and the contract with America. You covered the Clinton impeachment. Does it feel today like we're in a qualitatively different place? Does
yes.
this feel unprecedented?
Yes, absolutely. People ask me all the time, have you ever seen anything like this before? And the answer is no. We really haven't. We haven't seen this kind of attack on our intelligence services, on the First Amendment, on the judiciary system. We haven't seen policy being made by tweet. We haven't seen the kind of disruption in the federal government. The State Department is essentially home alone. There's nobody there. And at a time, at a very dangerous time. And so we are definitely in uncharted waters. Now, having said that, that's what the voters wanted. And I always said Trump would win. Everybody thought, oh, poor dear, you know, just passed it. But then in looking at the exit polls on election night, you looked at what people said was the most important issues to them. And brings needed change was by far the most important thing. I mean, by 20 points higher than the next thing, which was the economy. Excuse me. And then of the people who said the most important thing was brings needed change, 80% of them voted for Trump. So you have people who wanted to just throw everything up and see what happened because they thought that the way things were was not working for them.
I hadn't planned to relitigate the election.
No,
but
I don't either.
If it's
the
true, but I have
on the
to
other
ask
hand
you.
Does want to relitigate the election.
Right. But if it's true that this yearning need for change was central and that Trump appealed to those voters, could Hillary Clinton and the Democrats have done something differently that would have made the difference?
Sure, but it would have been hard because we really historically do not elect a party for a third term. And we did it with George Bush after Ronald Reagan, but normally we don't do that. And so it was always going to be uphill. And she also was a woman, you might have noticed. And school is still out on how detrimental that might have been. So there were those two things just going into it. And then the way the campaign was waged was, you saw it here in Pennsylvania, very much so in Pennsylvania. It was just not the way a traditional politician would have waged the campaign, which is also kind of interesting because there were all these brilliant young people who were just wedded to their data and their computers. And they had data on every single one of us, every single voter. They just didn't know how to get you to the polls, you know. They didn't know the old-fashioned get out the vote. And the Sunday before Election Day, the Clinton people called and did, you know, what we call spin calls, as you know, trying to talk us into their point of view. And I said to them, what are you doing about the fact that in every evangelical church in America today, there's a video of Mike Pence playing, and the buses will roll on Tuesday morning. And, you know, what, huh? You know, buses, churches, you know, new information.
You said that we're in a situation now where the State Department's home alone, the First Amendment's under attack, policies being made by tweet, and you say this like it's a bad thing. What can you tell us that is reassuring? Are there things that make you feel better?
Yes.
I've got some things, but I want to hear yours.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are a lot of things that are reassuring. You know, one of the things that continues to amaze me is how that group of guys meeting over the Independence Hall, not then at the State House, got it right. And, you know, they really, this tiny little group of people in these tiny little states huddled along the Atlantic coast, crafting by tremendous compromise a document that has served us well, lo these many years. And so what we are seeing is checks and balances. We are seeing the legislature not just being, as Jim Wright used to say, supine. And we are seeing the court's role, very much so, particularly on things like the travel ban. And we are seeing the press play a very important role, despite the fact that there's a certain amount of attack. So I think that the thing we can take solace from is that the system is working. You know, it's working the way it's supposed to be working, and that's, to me, a good thing.
We've got an interesting month ahead.
Yes.
The Republicans are determined to get a tax bill done. What do you think? Can they do it, and what does it mean for their prospects next year?
I think they're making a lot of the same mistakes the Democrats made on health care. Which is that they're so determined to get it done that they're going to do it in a partisan fashion, and so they own it. And that's exactly what McConnell said to the Democrats about health care. And then, you know, and then the Republicans ran against it and won in 2010. And I think that there's a lot in this tax bill that will be fodder for the Democrats to run against in 2018. So now, whether they can win or not is another issue. But I think this is a tax bill that's likely to come back and bite them.
It's so complicated, there's fodder for every argument.
That's true. And this morning on Morning Edition, we heard your senator, Pat Toomey, talking about some of the things that he thought were very beneficial in the bill. But there's so much in it that different people can pull out and say, this is bad. I mean, here's a really easy to understand example, right? This is nothing complex about this. A few years ago, Susan Collins of Maine inserted into the tax law a deduction for teachers, because you know how public school teachers particularly spend so much of their own money buying school supplies for their children because they are dedicated teachers. And so this is a deduction of $250 that they get for spending their own money on their kids. The Senate bill gets rid of that $250. That's so easy to explain, right? So they took away the money from the teachers who were buying things for their kids. So I can write that ad, and I'm not, you know.
I'm sure you can. On the other hand, you know, we have three suburban districts here in Philadelphia that are potentially swing districts,
right,
in the suburbs.
And of some of the few swing districts left, let me just, this is just a little tidbit of data that shows you how polarized the country has become. 20 years ago, there were 164, I think I have these numbers right, they're close enough, swing districts. Now there are about 70.
Right. And There's already been a campaign attack ads, well, at least on the internet in some of these districts. And when I looked into what the tax proposals would provide, it seemed that for most people in these suburban districts that you would regard as middle class, and there's some flexibility in how you would define it, most of them would see a tax benefit, at least until the 5 or 6 years when the deductions for them disappear. Even then, many of them keep a benefit. So it struck me that the Republicans, they've got that case to make. Now, of course, the cost of that is $1.5 trillion added to the deficit over 10 years.
Well, and also the people who live in the suburbs, as well as people who live every place else, belong to institutions that will be affected, whether it's a university or a public radio station or a hospital or whether they give to the American Cancer Society or any of those things, or give to a theater like this beautiful theater. You know, all of those institutions would be negatively affected by the tax bill. So that gets people's attention as well.
Okay, so we have the tax bill, and they're trying to assemble votes for that, and they've got to do it in the Senate, right? And then
they've already done it in the House.
Reconcile it and then back to both houses.
And that gets tough.
Right. And besides that, a week from Friday,
December 8th.
We have an Armageddon day. Right. That's the day when the government runs out of money unless there's another resolution.
How many times have we written that story, right?
Right.
The government runs out of money at midnight tonight. Whoops. They actually have some.
Right. Gosh, you sound like you've been here before. It's also the debt ceiling expires, right? And so Democrat gives Democrats leverage, right?
Because right, they, and they did that on purpose. So right. Today, right, actually as we speak, President Trump is meeting with the four leaders, with McConnell and Schumer and Pelosi and Ryan. And the last time that happened, McConnell and Ryan got whipped, and the president sided with his new best friends, Nancy and Chuck, and which he called them after that day. And they are the ones who wanted the December 8th, because they thought that would give them leverage, particularly over the deferred action for children.
The Dreamers. Right. But one of the fascinating things about this is we now are in a circumstance where those things that have to happen on December 8th, the continuing resolution to fund the government, lifting the debt ceiling, require Democratic support,
absolutely,
right? They require 60 votes in the Senate. But this drastic, once-in-a-lifetime overhaul of the tax code can be done on simple, straight majority votes. This is an Ask Cokie question. How can this be?
Oh, dear God, this is so complicated. So the Budget and Impoundment Act of 1974 has in it a provision that says that if you need to get the spending into the same place where the budget has set the numbers, you do that through a process called reconciliation. And that process only requires a majority vote.
Right.
So the reason that the tax bill had to come in at under $1.5 trillion in additional deficit spending was so that it could fit into the reconciliation outline and therefore can come to the Senate in under those auspices. So that's...
Well, I consider,
does that make any sense at all?
Well, I think there's an underlying point here about how completely inscrutable the budget, federal budget process is. And when I looked into this, I discovered that there was this Congressional Budget Act, which allowed Congress to pass a budget resolution which does not go to the president,
right,
and does not have the force of law.
Right.
But in that Budget Act, they make reconciliation directives to congressional committees.
Yeah.
And it is that which allows us to redraw the tax code on...
It's a really sort of sneaky way of doing it, to not put too fine a point on it, particularly since the House of Representatives is supposed to have the upper hand on the tax code. But the... just very brief history, because it is interesting. So after the Nixon presidency, which was called, as you might recall, Imperial Presidency, the Congress passed two big pieces of legislation in order to try to wrest the power back to that end of Pennsylvania Avenue. And, you know, pointing out correctly, again, that the guys meeting at Independence Hall made Congress Article One of the Constitution, not the executive. So the two big things they passed were the Budget Act and the War Powers Act, because the two big powers that had been given to Congress in the Constitution were the power of the purse and the power to declare war. And they felt that both of those powers had been eked away over the years and had, by the time of the end of the Nixon presidency, had been wholesalely brought to the other end of the avenue. So they were bringing it back. They have been variously successful. They have not always been successful because in the end, the appropriations committees do what they do. And sometimes, actually, that is the last little bastion of bipartisanship, where you will get them agreeing on things. But the Budget Act is there as a kind of disciplinary tool, and it has worked over the years to some degree. The War Powers Act, again, has worked over the years at least to the degree of forcing the presidents to report to Congress about what they're doing in terms of putting troops in harm's way. But it has certainly not given Congress a great deal more power in terms of declaring war, but that's their fault. That's because they're chicken about it.
So as December brings us these big consequential issues that Congress and the President will have to wrestle with, there's a special prosecutor doing his work.
Yes. And you didn't even mention the other issues they have. The children's health insurance has run out, and some states are going to run out of money by the end of the year, which is shocking. There is the Dreamer question. There is a big intelligence problem, aside from the investigation, where the intelligence agencies say they need Congress to pass legislation to allow them to intercept foreign communications on U.S. soil. Complicated, but they say essential. The Iran deal also has to be reconsidered in this period of time. So between now and Christmas, they have a huge amount on their plates, and whether they can get it done, it's very problematic that they can get it done. Yes, there is this investigation.
Yeah, it's a lot of tweets. So you've seen some investigations, too.
Yes.
A lot of special counsel. I'm just always fascinated how people on cable TV are all too happy to predict what's going to happen.
I know.
I saw Keith Olbermann in one of his commentaries the other day saying, absolutely going to happen. Trump's going to be out of here soon.
No.
Do you see a direction this is going to take?
Well, look, I mean, the day the special prosecutor was named, I was on the air. We were doing a special, and one of my colleagues said, oh, now, you know, it all is just what you're saying. Now it all goes underground. We won't hear anything for months. And I said, grand juries leak. Do you realize that? You know, I mean, now I'm distressed to say this special counsel has barely leaked at all. It's really depressing. But we certainly know who he's seen, you know, because people are staked out in front of his office. And it appears that Mike Flynn is now cooperating. So that can take it certainly in the direction of the campaign and the early days of the transition and the early days of the presidency. Do I think it's going to lead to the president being forced out? Absolutely not. But are there people around the president who could be in deep trouble? Sure.
Why are you sure about the president?
I'm not sure, but I just don't think that it's the kind of thing he does. He's not that involved in detail. And I mean that seriously. He's a big picture guy, as he would say. And I would be surprised if he sat down and said, you do this, I do that, that kind of thing. I think we need to, we in the press and in the American people, need to keep focused on what is really important here. And you say I've covered previous special counsels, and I certainly have. And the place where we lost focus was in the Iran-Contra investigation, where I think we as a press corps blew it. And I think that's because it was so soon after Watergate, and everybody was following the mantra of follow the money and all that, and it was so complicated with country A and country B and all that stuff, that we didn't get to the fundamental unconstitutionality of hiring a private army to carry out policy in contravention of the policy enunciated by the elected representatives of the people. That was a shocking unconstitutional abrogation, and we didn't ever get that across the American people. What is important in this investigation is that the Kremlin was messing around in our elections and trying to influence the outcome, and is still messing around in our elections and trying to influence the outcome. And even if they don't care about the outcome, they want to undermine American democracy. That's what this investigation is about. And that is a really important thing to keep in mind. We spent the whole end of the last century, second half of the last century, spending tremendous time, treasure, talent, losing lives to keep that from happening. And here we are.
Well, I mean, the special counsel can't indict Putin, right?
No.
He's going to have to go after
Americans
who collaborate. Right. You know, coming back to your point that Trump is not a detail guy, he would not have been involved in details. Well, one might say, well, Richard Nixon didn't plan Watergate. It was the cover-up that got him. And that Trump may impulsively try to fire Robert
James Comey.
Well, and already did fire Comey. Right. And that in some respects, that is where he may be vulnerable.
Yes, that's quite possible. I mean, that and that is what we always do see. You know, look, Bill Clinton got impeached over lying to a grand jury. But that started with a Paula Jones inquiry.
A deposition. Yeah. While we're on the president, and we're not going to be on him the whole hour.
It's hard to avoid him.
Yeah. You know, I covered, I mean, this was a battleground state. I covered some of his rallies. And I have to say, it was hard not to be impressed with his skill as a showman.
Right.
And, you know, I thought once he
And
mocked,
by the size of those crowds and the enthusiasm, all of that.
I mean, I thought once he mocked John McCain's war record, and he would be finished. Once he skated away from that, I said, wow, something different is happening here.
Right.
And he skated away from so many things. And now as president, I mean, it's amazing the way he can get himself in trouble and just move on. And, you know, he's taken fake news, which was originally coined a term coined for people, for stories planted essentially to help him. And now that's the New York Times and the Washington Post.
And CNN.
And CNN. And I'm wondering, it strikes me that he is an extraordinary talent at what he does. Do you think he is different, or he just came along at the right time in American political history, or both?
I think both. One of the mistakes that I think a lot of college-educated voters who did not vote for Trump, they, you know, the that was not his voter, made the mistake, and this includes me, we didn't watch The Apprentice. I'm serious about this. Millions and millions and millions of people watched The Apprentice. And I didn't see it until after the election. And when I saw it, I was just gobsmacked. Because what you see there is what you're seeing. And you see this man sort of sitting in the middle of a table, looking like he's very much in charge. And he's got his kids on either side, and they're just, you know, they're props. And he's making decisions, and he's making them in a forceful manner, and he, you know, seems to be very much in charge. And I think that is what people were attracted to. And it was very interesting. The day that he had to announce that the House was pulling the repeal of Obamacare, he was in the Oval Office, and he was sitting at a desk just like The Apprentice. I was just, wow, now I recognize it. And he had Pence and the former HHS guy who just had to leave, Price. Price and Pence standing behind him like his kids, and they all had blue ties. And I thought, this is The Apprentice. This is completely recognizable to millions and millions and millions of Americans. So instead of it looking like he was being weak because the bill was being pulled, he was back to his very strong stance. And I do think that makes him a different character in our politics. And the times also were such that the desire for change was enormous. And I'll just do this quickly. But really what we've been going through in this country is the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution, where everybody had to leave the farm, or most people, and go to the city or go across the ocean. Their lives totally disrupted. And what used to be valued was no longer valued. What was valued was your product, not your time. But once you started working in a factory, it was your time. And that was particularly true for women who did home manufacture. And once the Industrial Revolution happened, that was no longer valued, and they went to work in the factories. The technological revolution has had a very similar impact on people. It's not globalization, it's technology. And jobs that used to be wonderful jobs don't exist anymore, and expectations of what your life is going to be are completely disrupted, and of what your children's life is going to be is completely disrupted. And so it's an unmooring of a lot of people. And then you put on top of that cultural change, where you have gay marriage and you have maybe living next door to you someone of a darker skin that you never expected to have before because you always lived in a homogeneous neighborhood. All of that is upsetting to people. And to have Donald Trump come and basically say you can have it back the way it used to be, which is totally absurd, of course, but it sounded great. And so that was the time and the man that did it.
So in 4 years, will those who bought that argument feel let down?
Depends. If I had to predict right now, I'd say he'd be reelected, even with his low approval ratings. I know. But the...
the interesting thing about the low approval ratings, he's at 38% now. He only won 46%
exactly.
of the popular vote.
And, and there will be a campaign.
Right.
And, when you say, will people still like him or will they vote for him, what's the alternative? And that's really the big question.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next. The alternative.
I was giving you a sort of.
I mean, the Democrats. Well, I mean, they're plugging away, but I mean, the rebranding kind of fizzled. You got Donna Brazile writing a book, taking shots at the Clinton campaign. Where do you see this party going?
Well, they've really got to figure it out. I mean, the truth is that the people who are at the top of the party at the moment are good leaders. Nancy Pelosi is a first-rate legislative leader. And Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, they're all older than me, and I'm old. And, yesterday I had the delightful experience on the train where I was getting off, and a voice behind me says, can I help you with that bag? And I said, oh, it's light, no problem, and I'm still not looking. And he says, well, what about my tip? And I turn around and it's Joe Biden. he gives me a big hug. I love him. But he's older than me, too. And they really have to figure out how to have some fresh faces and appeal to people who are looking at the current leaders and saying, been there, done that.
Well, let's talk about some fresh faces in a moment, but it's interesting what you were saying about if we are going through a transformation akin to the Industrial Revolution and the Technological Revolution and cultural changes, spinning people's lives in different directions. It sounds like what you're saying is Trump brought kind of an illusory solution to that. Is there a smarter information-based argument
that the
Democrats can do.
Sure there is. And the most important thing, you look at unemployment statistics and it's just striking how with each level of education the unemployment rate goes down dramatically, with the one exception of PhDs. that PhD in art history, not cutting it.
Just to be clear, the way you phrased that, you're saying more educated people suffer less unemployment.
Right. The more educated you are, the more employed you are. And the answer for an awful lot of people who are feeling that they are left out, especially for younger people, is good community colleges, good education that gets you where you need to go. You can't be a UPS driver now without being able to work a computer and know and track packages and do all of that. You can't do it. During the last election, when Trump was winning in South Carolina, and I was there the primary time, Marriott Hotels announced that they were going to make every towel in for every American hotel of theirs in America. And so everybody was so excited in South Carolina, textile state, right? And so a couple of plants opened, hired total, and there are millions of towels. They said how many, you know, there were like 4 million bath towels, 20 million hand towels, whatever, washcloths, all of it. And
everybody wants towels.
Right, and hotels especially. And the total was like 200 people. A textile mill is a beautiful place now. It's clean. You have some in South Philadelphia. They have whirring machines that don't, they barely make any noise. They don't produce all that lint. But somebody's got to work those machines, and that's who they hire, is the people who can work those machines, and they're complicated. So, you know, education is the answer, but putting that into a whole package that works for all Americans is something the Democrats have had a terrible trouble.
And Bernie Sanders was talking about education for everybody. I've had Republican operatives tell me they think Bernie would have beat Trump. Do you?
No.
No.
You know, nobody ever ran against Bernie in this campaign. But by the end, could Biden have beaten Trump? Maybe. He couldn't have won in the Democratic primary until then. But he, by the end of the campaign, it's possible that he could have beaten Trump.
There's another institutional problem in the country, and that is partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah.
And there's a view.
You have a little of that going on here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Our delegation is we have 13 Republicans, 5 Democrats in it.
And with the voter registration.
Voter registration is about a million more Democrats. Right. And the actual votes are kind of down the middle. But, I mean, there's an argument that the Republicans in 2010 were so effective in taking control of state legislatures,
right,
which then controlled not just congressional redistricting, but legislative redistricting,
right,
so that they're set for the next time. And they've sort of put a stranglehold on the electoral process and can win even when they don't have the votes. You agree?
Yeah, I think and in some states, it's the Democrats have done the same thing. I live in Maryland where that happened. I do think that the drawing of district lines, the way they are now drawn, is a tremendous problem, not just in terms of the elections, but in terms of the behavior in Congress. This is the most polarized Congress we've seen since the Civil War, and the fact is that the way that the lines are drawn makes it so that the only challenge you have is a primary challenge, and those challenges are ideological purists. So the only way you can get in trouble is to not be left enough if you're a Democrat or right enough if you're a Republican. And so it makes compromise and getting anything done in the Congress almost impossible. Now, having said that, it's also a very polarized Senate, and there are no district lines drawn there. So what we're also seeing is the big sort of people moving to places where people think like them. And so what you do see is Democrats along the coast and in the big cities, and Republicans pretty much the rest of the country. And it has an impact, again.
The table's tilted,
yeah.
You know, the last federal case for partisan gerrymandering that went to the U.S. Supreme Court was from the Pennsylvania redistricting in 2000. And the courts have been reluctant to interfere with it. They regard it as an inherently political process. But I think, you know, the examples of it are so extreme, some of them right here in the Philly suburbs, that the courts are now considering, because there's now a mathematical way to estimate.
Although that is so complicated. Oh, my God. I mean, when you start reading through
it's
that
less complicated
stuff
than the federal budget.
But I don't think so. I know the budget. But
they have a shot in the courts?
I think they do. So just to back up for a second. We have always had gerrymandering. It's named after Elbridge Gerry, right? One of the founders. So we've had it from the beginning. In fact, I could tell you a very funny story about the first drawing of district lines, not even redistricting. I'll just say it really quick. So James Madison is running for Congress in the first Congress. And Patrick Henry is governor of Virginia. And Patrick Henry hates the Constitution. And he wants to elect anti-constitutionalists. So he draws a district. And he had complete control of the legislature. He draws a district, looks like this. So every anti-constitutionalist is in these fingers, right? And James Monroe runs against James Madison, who's here in Philadelphia. And George Washington says to James Madison, I've been home and you're going to lose. And Madison says, moi? You know, I am the father of the Constitution. And Washington says, that's your problem. And, so he goes to Virginia, discovers he's going to lose. He was running against James Monroe. And he promises a Bill of Rights. And he wins. And he gets to the first Congress and he says, now we have to do a Bill of Rights. And everybody says, are you out of your mind? We've just gone through the worst ratification fight of all time. And we've now got to form a government and have a currency and all that stuff, and you want a Bill of Rights? And he said, campaign promise. So that's how we got a Bill of Rights. So we've always had it. But the difference now is computers. And computers can find voters in any neck of the state who are like-minded to the incumbent and put them all in that district. And so it is very different from what it used to be. The most recent Supreme Court decision was not about partisanship, but was indirectly related to it, which was the Arizona case of a special commission drawing the lines as opposed to the state legislature. And frankly, I thought they were going to rule the other way because the Constitution's pretty clear about it. The state legislature draws the lines. But they ruled that the state legislature could convey its power to the citizenry through a referenda. And the referendum had established the commission. And so the court found the commission constitutional. That's the most hopeful path, is for states to do that, because those are the most competitive seats.
In the post-Harvey Weinstein world, we're in a whole different situation. Every day,
every
it
day.
Seems, there's a new set of allegations. And, I keep talking about how long we've been around, but you were reporting in Congress at a time when there weren't many women in Congress and many women reporting in Congress.
No.
What did you experience?
You needed to run fast. Linda Wertheimer has a story about a senator who was literally chasing her around the desk, and she said the problem was he was so slow that she kept catching up to him. And there were always, don't get in the elevator with that guy. But that's happened in a lot of places of business. But the person who stood out was Strom Thurmond, who sort of every 22 years married a 22-year-old. And when my daughter was 22, I said, go home. But he was notorious. And in fact, kissed me live on the lips during a convention interview. But he was just being friendly. He really was just being friendly. But there you are. You know, what are you supposed to do? You got a microphone in your hand, you're in an interview. Ah, Senator.
I heard you say this the other day on the radio.
Right.
Was it like in a greeting, hello, Cokie? Or was it just in the middle of things out of nowhere?
No, it was hello, Cokie, but it was still a kiss on the mouth, live on the air, from a really old guy. And, I mean, you are left, with no recourse in that kind of situation.
Right. Right. Hard to know what to do.
Right.
Your mom, Lindy Boggs, served eight terms?
Nine terms.
Nine terms in Congress after your father died. What kind of a place was it for her?
Well, nobody would mess with my mother. It's interesting. When I went off to work after college, this was 1964, and I was working for a television production company that had produced shows in various cities, including here. I was here a lot at KYW. And as I went off on my first business trip, and I was 20 years old, my mother drove me to the airport. And she said, Cokie, things might happen. And here was her view. She said, try not to think less of those men. So that was the era, right? And it was just the sense that, I was going to be subjected to things and I was going to have to just try to live with it.
I wonder if the election in Alabama will tell us whether we're truly in a new era in that respect.
I suspect Roy Moore will win. It's the fact that it's teenagers might sway some people, but the popular wisdom at the moment is that it will all come down to suburban Republican women and whether they can stomach it. But we are at this moment of party over principle on both sides. And women's groups would have never given a Republican president the pass that they gave Bill Clinton because, you know, he voted with them. And the last exit poll taken in Alabama was in 2012. Because that was the last time there was anything even vaguely contested. And at that point, 16% of white women voted for Obama. So their experience voting for a Democrat is not high.
Mm-hmm. We're now in a place where, you know, new allegations come out all the time, and they're different. And
right.
One can make distinctions among the kind of conduct alleged. And I'm wondering, what is the standard? What should end one's career? Should Al Franken leave the Senate?
We don't know what the standard is. The younger women seem to think that that any advance is grounds for dismissal. They grew up in a different world. And we older women kind of roll our eyes at some of it, and that's not well accepted. I think the only thing to do as a member of the press is to just put it out there and say, he did this, he did this, you decide. In any individual employment situation, it's really up to the company or the board of trustees or the shareholders or whoever it is, and in the case of politicians, it's up to the voters.
Ultimately, yeah.
Ultimately. Now, with Bob Packwood, he got elected. Now, the stories weren't all out when he got elected. But then the Ethics Committee conducted an investigation that went on for a couple of years, of course, and lots of women came forward, and the Ethics Committee voted to expel him unanimously, with Mitch McConnell leading it. And he then quit before he forced his colleagues to vote on expulsion. So it's not just the voters. It can also be the body.
Right, and senators do have six-year terms.
Right.
And so that can take a while. And, you know, we should note that NPR has had its problem with this. Michael Orestes, the senior vice president for news, resigned after a whole series of allegations. I think a lot of people would like to think that NPR is the kind of place where this would not likely happen, that people are more humane there. How do you feel they've handled it?
I actually think in the end they've handled it fine, but there's a lot of upset, and again, among the younger people. And one of the things that's heartbreaking, frankly, for those of us who've been there forever, is that they didn't come to us, because we could have protected them. We old ladies, you know, we're tough, and we could have helped.
Wait,
and
if they'd gone to you and said Orestes did this to me, you would have gone and gotten in his face, and or what?
Right.
Or gone to HR. Yeah.
Both. Yeah.
And did it happen when you were young?
Oh, sure.
Within NPR.
Yes. Yes.
And what did you do then?
Some of the victims didn't complain, and that's what some of these men say, you know. Charlie Rose says, I thought it was all consensual.
Right. I guess, stop me if this goes too far, but it's not like you suffered some of this.
Oh, everybody did.
And did you complain?
So it's a question of what you're talking about. I was not subject to abuse. It was just come-ons.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, it is interesting to wonder if the Access Hollywood tape had come out now rather than during the campaign, what its impact would have been.
You mean because you think the climate has changed?
Yeah, because if the presumption now is that if a dozen women make an accusation, they're more likely
to. See, I think we're still right in the middle of this. We don't know how this is going to play out. It could all have such a backlash. I'm very nervous about this. I'm very nervous that this is going to end up hurting women. And that people will start to say, well, do we really want to hire a woman? You know, is she going to make trouble? Is it, you know, all of that. Now, they're going to have trouble not hiring women because we're the majority of college graduates and the vast majority of graduate school graduates.
And you're smarter than us.
That's true. But but I fear a backlash. And you're already beginning to see it in bits and places, the word witch hunt, all of that being used. And so I don't know how it would have played down.
Coming back to the Democrats, do you see a presidential candidate for 2020?
Not at the moment. There are a lot of interesting, smart Democrats all over the country, but none of them has come forward. But at this point, we didn't see Barack Obama as a presidential candidate.
Right.
No, right. So, you know, I always joke, American politics can change overnight. Just ask Gary Hart. But the but it's true. It is true. So, you know, sitting here in 2017 predicting 2020 would be a fool's errand. So we do it, but we know. But
can you predict 2018?
2018 is going to be very tough for the Democrats because of the gerrymandering. There are just not that many, as I said earlier, swing districts. But you sometimes get a wave. And I think off-year elections are the equivalent of a parliamentary vote of no confidence. And so we use them to say, wait, that's not what I had in mind, right? And that happened in 94 when Bill Clinton had run in 92 as a new Democrat and then governed as an old Democrat. The Republicans win the House for the first time in 50 years. And then in 2006 with George Bush, and then again in 2010 with Barack Obama, with voters saying, that's not what we meant. So here's the question for 2018. In all of those cases, it was voters saying, you've overstepped, you've overreached, right? In this case, I think it would have to be, you haven't done anything. And then the question is, do they think anybody can do anything? And that's what's so dispiriting about the way the district lines are drawn, is that it makes people feel powerless. And they're not powerless, but it makes them feel that way. And people are beginning to feel like no matter who we elect, nothing comes out the way we want it to come out. And that's also not a good sign for American democracy. So the question is, do people believe that they can make a difference? And if they do believe it, they'll show up.
Right. I mean, as any election, it's not just what the electorate believes, but which parts of them show up in numbers.
Right.
And I don't want to read too much into it, but it was interesting that
Virginia.
I was going to mention Virginia, certainly. But in Philadelphia, there were a bunch of suburban county row office elections, sheriff, register of wills, county council. And in three of the four suburban Philadelphia counties, Democrats captured county offices that they had never captured
That's
before.
That's interesting.
And I think that was because of, you know, there's clearly an energy among Democrats.
Well, and that was certainly true in Virginia, and not only among Democrats as a party, but particularly among female Democrats. And the state legislature, the House of Delegates, which is still not settled, they're still counting, but it went from 17 to 27 female members. And Northam, the Democratic elected governor now, won women by 22 points. And he won Democrats by 8 points more than Hillary Clinton did. So I do think you're right that there's an energy there, and that can make a huge difference in turnout. Because traditionally what we've seen in off-year elections is turnout is low, and it tends to be older people who turn out no matter what, and older people tend to vote more Republican. And so that's been an advantage for Republicans in off years. But we'll see what happens next time around.
I want to talk a bit about the media and reporting. You covered Congress for more than 10
Forever.
Years. Forever. And, you know, I mean, I've covered legislative bodies, and it is it is such a daunting task because you've got hundreds of members. There are committee meetings. There's legislation to read. You need to talk to leadership, members, their staff, people affected. And unlike newspaper reporters, if you're doing it for radio, you've got to get broadcast quality sound, not easy in echoey hallways and on the phone. And you did this while you were a mom.
Yeah, that was hard. That was hard. It really was. I look back on those years and get sick to my stomach. I mean, we were filing. First of all, Morning Edition came on the air in that period. And so I was filing for two big magazines a day. And often we would have special reports or live coverage of something and all of that. And my kids, when I started in PR, my kids were 7 and 9. And we didn't have any money. My husband was a reporter for the New York Times. So, you know, no Mary Poppins was flying in. And so it was a lot of work. But I'm happy to tell you they are now middle-aged, lovely people, and it's their problem.
Well, you know, the thing about going through all of that is that it gives you a ground-level feel.
Right.
And a really deep insight that you don't get from reading a few newspaper articles. And now that you have reached the exalted and well-deserved status of an analyst, how do you get that feel? How do you feel like you can burrow into an issue?
Well, you know, what's nice is people will take my phone calls.
Yep.
So I can still get the information I need. But you know what? I always said that covering Congress, now it was absolutely essential to be there and in the hallways and in the speaker's lobby and all of that. But my gut is very good on it. And I always thought the two things that were the best preparation were taking political theory and motherhood. Wow. And there were times, I must say, in a debate when I did feel like getting down there and saying, I don't care who started it, I'm stopping it, you know. And people would ask me about bias, and I would always say, my bias is dinner. You know, do it by dinner time. I don't care whether you're pro-contra or anti-contra, just do it. And there's a lot of truth to that. It was interesting. Steve and I were both covering Congress, and that had its pluses and minuses, mainly pluses. We were, since he was print and I was broadcast, we could help each other. And when we'd finally get in the car to come home, my children revealed to us many years later that they ate at somebody else's house first. And then had my dinner, which they said was always better. We would have that conversation that parents have at the end of the day in the car on the way home. So by the time we did walk into the house, we were the kids, you know, we were theirs. But I'll tell you an interesting story of a two-reporter family. I had covered the 1978 Dick Thornburgh election to the governor. And having stepped foot in Harrisburg, I was sent immediately to Three Mile Island. I was also one of the few NPR reporters who could drive. Many of them grew up in Manhattan. And, so I could get in my car and go to Harrisburg, to Pershing. And then the New York Times tried to assign my husband, and he said, we can't have two parents in Three Mile Island while it's blowing up. So that was a new moment for him.
You know, you're a broadcast news analyst, and there are so many people on TV offering analysis. And I'm wondering...
Or opinion.
Yeah, or speculation or whatever. Are there people that you trust that you... whose information you...
You know, I don't watch any of that, but...
Well, that's kind of reassuring. We are making your calls instead of watching them.
Yeah, I don't watch that stuff. Huh. That's one of the real problems in journalism today. The 24/7 news cycle means that people are having to file so much that a lot of the reporting is derivative. You know, they're taking somebody else's reporting because they're having to file. And when that all just, the very beginning of that happened while I was still covering The Hill every day, and I basically said, stop. I'm here to report. I've got to get downstairs to the chamber and talk to people. I can't be up here in the booth filing cuts of tape. You know, that's not what I do. And so it's a problem, and a lot of people suffer from this problem.
It is interesting when you look at Washington reporting, because there are so many reporters now, and there are a zillion outlets, because all you need is a website, right? And there are, you know, smart,
aren't they
young,
all wonderful?
Right. Smart, young, aggressive, ambitious reporters all competing for scoops. The other thing that strikes me is how often anonymous sources are used. I was looking at a New York Times piece in September by Glenn Thrush, speaking of an earlier subject, and Maggie Haberman about the chief of staff, John Kelly. And it was this amazing story about how Trump had upbraided him, and he said he had never been spoken to like that in his entire career in public service and wouldn't do it again. And if you read through the whole story, it's a fascinating story about Kelly and his relationship with Trump, and there's not a single named source for anything. The only named source is actually Roger Stone, the renegade consultant who's sort of commenting on it. But I'm wondering, I trust Thrush and Haberman.
The source on that, if I had to guess,
yeah,
the source on that was Donald Trump.
Well, could be. But why would Trump say?
Because he talks to Haberman.
Okay, but why would he tell him that John Kelly complained he'd never been spoken to that in his entire career?
Bragging about it.
He's bragging. Wow. I showed him. I put him in his place. I guess that what I'm raising is that.
I mean, I'm making it up.
Yeah. Okay, right.
It's a good guess.
You could say to, yeah, right, according to two people familiar with the conversation from somebody else. I guess what I'm getting at is that it's, while I may trust the New York Times to be careful about anonymous sources, once it's sort of permitted to base things on them, God, anybody can almost report anything.
Yeah, but if you got rid of anonymous sources, you'd lose a lot of very valuable information, particularly information that I think the voters have a right to know about national security. And it's very hard to get people to go on the record there.
Agreed.
I think the place you have to be careful, most careful, is when people are denigrating somebody else. You know, if he's just got an axe to grind against this guy, you know, I don't think it's fair to just say that. If, on the other hand, you're getting a whole kind of chorus of disgruntled members of Congress over their leadership, and none of them is willing to go on the record, but you're hearing enough of it, that's worth reporting.
Yeah, I agree. And if you're reporting facts, then the parties can deny them. And if they don't, it kind of...
I mean, the joy of covering Congress is that you can literally walk down the hall and pop a balloon. And, you know, I always joke that people would ask me in the early days what it was like being a woman covering Congress. The truth is they don't care about the initials in front of your name. It's the initials after your name. And, you know, NPR was in every district in America, and so they were eager to talk to me. And I always joke that walking around the halls of Congress with a microphone, that you use it as a weapon, you know. Down, boy, you know.
It is amazing the effect when you put a microphone on someone's face.
Right. So in Congress, you can really, the behind the chamber of the House of Representatives, there's a hallway, really, that's called the Speaker's Lobby, and the press is allowed in there. And you could go in and talk to the Democrats at this end and the Republicans at this end. I mean, these are things you put up with. They would walk in, because the best way to get them is when they were all assembling for a vote, right? And they'd walk in, and I'd be standing at the door, and they'd do this, every single one. Hi, Cokie, hi, Cokie, hi, Cokie, hi, Cokie. And I had what I called speaker's lobby bruises. But there's a lot of touching.
All right, I want to get to some audience questions, and I was given some index cards that I'm having trouble.
Here comes some.
There we go. Thank you.
Christine on the case.
Christine, she is good. Okay. I haven't looked at these, so I'll just read them. When you were on This Week, I found TV-based debate/discussion very informative, respectful, and engaging. Now I cannot even watch that kind of forum. In your view, what needs to happen to bring editorial news back to a place that allows people to think and draw conclusions based on reasoning and fact?
Well, I think it's going to be very hard. When we were doing, when it was George Will, Sam Donaldson, and me, we respected each other. We had different views, and it was. But I always learned something from them, and they learned from me, and I think that that's just kind of gone now. In general, men still sort of just wait for women's lips to stop moving, and don't listen. But on television, that's become true for both sexes. People don't listen to what the other person's saying. They're just waiting to get in and get their, get their voice heard. And that's a shame.
I have to say.
I don't see any way to bring it back anytime soon. I think that, what tends to happen is that you go through periods. So, whether the period is the Western or the TV news magazine or the reality show, right now it's talking heads on TV. And my guess is we'll get through this period and everybody will say, well, we're tired of that.
I'm just going to add as an aside, you talked about you and Sam Donaldson actually listening to each other. It is so distressing to see how many Americans kind of listen to one kind of news
right.
and don't really talk to people they don't know. What a gift it has been for me as a journalist to have to talk to people
Absolutely.
Every day. And
I
don't know how to
Dave, we don't have to tell these people because they're very nice about giving money, but we've got the best jobs on earth. it's a license to snoop. But also you're a witness to history, and the privilege of that is just incredible.
What is your assessment of the educational system or the education department under the monitoring of Betsy DeVos?
The department doesn't seem to have doesn't seem to have had the same kind of hit as some of the other departments. It's interesting that she's become such a lightning rod because she's been part of the education reform, whatever that means, world for a very long time. And there are a lot of people who are on the side of better standards and all that who like her. But she is vilified, of course, by the teachers' unions, and that becomes an issue with all these things. But I don't think that department has had the same kind of straight-out ideological attack as, for instance, the EPA has had. We're about to see at the CFPB where we have two heads at the moment. So there's some where people have come in with a very strong ideological view that department should not exist. And that's been a much stronger element in other parts of the government.
Are there advantages to the Electoral College?
Yes. I'm a pro-Electoral College. My father apparently put in an amendment to get rid of the Electoral College as one of his original measures in Congress, but he was wrong. Here's why I like the Electoral College. I do think that it's important not to have a national election, to go to states. Just the stuff you and I have just been talking about. You learn something. You listen to people. You find something very different in Idaho than you do in Pennsylvania. So if you just had a national campaign, it would be money, ads, all of that, and not any of that on the ground getting to see voters. But more important from my perspective is the voice the Electoral College gives to minority voters. And one of the last interviews I did with Ron Brown before he was killed, when he was chairman of the Democratic National Committee, was as an African-American, talking about the importance of the Electoral College. Because you look at the nationwide, the African-American vote is about 10 to 12%. But you look in various states, and it's much higher and has to be paid attention to. And that's true of the Hispanic vote. It's particularly true of the Jewish vote. So that you have various places where minority voices are heard where they wouldn't be in a national election.
Although if they're not in a battleground state.
But battleground states change. They're not always the same. New Jersey used to be a battleground state and isn't much anymore. Pennsylvania became one again. Texas has gone from not battle, from battleground to not battleground. It's about to go back to battleground. Florida, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in Florida with the influx of Puerto Ricans, who are all American citizens. It's not set in stone what's a battleground state. They vary.
Okay. I don't know if I should be reading names with these. This questioner says, I feel it's time for the baby boomers to step back and let the youth, quote unquote, step up. Who do you see as the Democratic strong leaders of the future?
So I'm older than the baby boomers. I was born during the war, so they still seem a little young. But especially the bottom of them, the last of them were born in 1964. But there are, as I said earlier, lots of young, interesting Democrats, both in the state houses and in the Senate. You can look at somebody like Kirsten Gillibrand or Amy Klobuchar. You can look at Cory Booker. There are people around who are saying interesting things and are engaging personalities.
If they want to be a serious presidential candidate 2020, they have to start soon.
Well, some of them probably are.
Yeah. What will the Democratic and Republican parties look like in 20 years? Crystal ball here.
Well, you know, one of the really stupid things that pundits do is write parties off. And that has not been, we have not written a party off since the Whigs in 1856. So I think the Democratic and Republican parties will be around. The question is, do they stay regional as they are right now and ideological as they are right now, much more European than they used to be? I think the big change will come with demography. And the Republicans know this. They know that they cannot remain the party of white people, and particularly of white men. During the 2008 Democratic primaries, lots of reporters called the Census Bureau and said, when did white men stop being the majority? And people in the Census said they never were. And finally, one fed-up person said, they just always acted like it. And in the voting population, white men are about 33%, and white men under 50 are considerably fewer than that. So the Republicans know they have to do more by way of reaching out to minorities and to women. And so I think that that's why the entire party establishment, with the exception of the president, has landed on Roy Moore and said, get out of here, because they see that as a detriment to their ability to widen their base.
Many journalists are known for having a particular beat or affiliation with a distinct network or broadcasting outlet. How do you manage to cover so many historical and political topics for NPR, ABC, and PBS, while also writing a weekly column and researching books, which you're doing here?
Well, my husband mainly writes the column, dirty little secret. He's the one who likes it, and so he gets to write it. I tend to write it when I'm really mad about something. And if you see one that says, wah, 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 that's me. But the books are the thing that really take the time. But I think they're important. They're important to me. And I think they're important. I don't want to be too grandiose here, but I think it's important for Americans to learn about the women of our history. It's the other half of the human race. You know, if you don't know what women were doing, you don't know the full history of the country. And so I think, and I love learning it, I must admit, but I also love telling people about it.
Well, and we're grateful that you managed to find time to visit us. Do you do a lot of work like this for member stations?
I do think that it's very important to support member stations. I do go to a lot of member stations. We wouldn't exist without you. And as I said earlier upstairs, what's happening now in our stations, particularly WHYY, is a real focus on covering local news. The work you do, the work that your colleagues do is so essential, because what we're learning all over the country is that local newspapers are disappearing or shrinking to such a degree that they really are not keeping academic or business or political feet to the fire. And that needs to be done for the community as a whole. And also, those institutions need to be celebrated as well. And that all has to be at the local level. And it's expensive to do, but it's important to do. So that's why I go to try to help as often as I can, and that's why I'm thrilled that all of you all are here, because that's what you're doing, is making that possible.
Well said. Another question. Why does cable and print media insist on breaking down polling data by college-educated and those who are high school-educated? Haven't they figured out that breakdown of data is insulting to non-college educated voters, implying they're not smart enough to vote for the right candidate?
Well, it's not meant to be insulting. It's just meant to be descriptive. I mean, we break it down by race. We break it down by age. We break it down by religion. We break it down by those who go to church and those who don't go to church. I mean, we break down all of our voting data in as many categories as we can to try to understand what's going on. And it's not meant in any way to say, oh, you don't know who to vote for. It's a way of saying, huh, here's who you voted for. Now we need to know why and see what the policies are that would make a difference and who the personalities are who make a difference. It's a question of learning.
Where do you see the U.S. post-Trump, which for you, I guess, is 2024, huh?
Mm-hmm. It might be. Well, I had a really, really scary conversation in the green room on Sunday with Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who says he's more concerned about Korea than he has been in a very long time. And that obviously there was another missile test overnight. And the concern that Kim Jong-un is determined to get a nuclear weapon, which is clear, and that President Trump is determined that he not. And that could be a very, very dangerous situation. That is the, when you talk about post-Trump, that is the place that keeps me up at night.
How could we refocus news coverage on meaningful issues versus the latest tweet?
So there's a whole argument going on about whether this is on purpose. And there are a lot of people who think that the president just, you know, emotes. I think it might be more purposeful than that, that he's sort of waving bright, shiny objects in front of us so we won't talk about issues. So, for instance, yesterday, when in front of the Navajo code talkers, first of all, he's standing in front of that portrait of Andrew Jackson with the Indians in the room, and then he starts going off on Pocahontas and Elizabeth Warren. It was just so weird. But you sit there and think, he doesn't want to be in this room with these people. And what's he going to do to get to his base today? And that's what he did. And what did we cover? That's what we covered. Because it is so weird. And it is news. But is he doing that so we don't say the Republicans don't have the votes on the tax bill? Maybe. And that's what I think we have to be very careful about. But I get a lot of pushback on that.
Hmm. Yeah, you want to do it all, but the question is sort of what leads.
Right.
Right.
Right. And how much attention do you want to draw to these kind of zuny things?
Right. I have a question here. What, in your opinion, was the number one reason for Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton?
I think I talked about that, right? That sense of feeling like the country wasn't the country I grew up in.
You know, the this partisan gridlock that we've seen in Washington preceded this president.
Absolutely.
Sure. And I know I've heard you talk about it. I mean, you were a child of Washington. Your dad was a congressman, and then your mom. And that there was a day long ago when members didn't flee the Capitol every weekend to go back and raise money or be on local television.
And or do constituent service,
or constituent
be fair.
Fair enough, right. But it made for a different set of relationships.
Right, very much so. Very much so. I think the business of not bringing your family to Washington has had almost as big an impact as the drawing of district lines. That people don't get to know each other. They see each other as an enemy, not an opponent. And, you know, my last interview with President Ford, which is one I did for WHYY, we were doing a series on former presidents and the Constitution. And after we turned off the cameras, he said to me, you know, Cokie, I just don't understand what's going on in Washington. And this is ages ago now, right? And he said, you know, when your dad was majority leader and I was minority leader, we would get in a cab together and we would go down to someplace like the press club. This was an exaggeration. They had drivers. But he said, and we'd say, what are we going to argue about? And he said it was a legitimate argument. We did disagree about how to get to where we wanted to get to, or even if we wanted to get there. And it was partisan. For God's sake, we were the leaders of our parties in the House of Representatives. But then we'd get back in the cab and be best friends. And that was absolutely true. And that is gone. I mean, absolutely gone. And they don't even know people in their own party. Much less people in the other party. So that there's none of that just sense of camaraderie where you understand that the person is a good person who's there to serve the public and that you might think he's wrong-headed, but you don't have to think he's evil. And that's kind of where we are now, people thinking each other is evil. And it's very hard to do business that way.
Right. And it's troubling to see how many members of Congress are hanging it up because they just
they
don't
want to
like
deal with
that
it.
Way.
And that's a real problem too, because the best answer to all of this is to elect more women. And because honestly, really, I'm not just saying it, because it really is the place where you see more cooperation. But women really look at that kind of nastiness and say, "Do I want to get involved in that?" So then it creates a vicious circle.
No, it's just running a campaign is such a distasteful process. Right. Covering it's a distasteful process.
And raising the money. And it's much harder for women to raise the money still.
For many years, there's been this no-labels movement in Congress. Uh-huh. And now there's this problem solvers caucus, which is exactly designed at focusing on common ground and real solutions. Has it helped?
I think they're beginning to gain some steam, and I think the more they get out there and talk, the better it is. I mean, in the end, it's the voters have to make this decision. You know, voters have to start rewarding people who cooperate rather than punishing them, which is the current situation. And I think that to the degree that you have smart, sensible people saying this is what needs to happen, that's a useful thing. It hasn't picked up enough traction yet, but I think, give them some opportunity to do it.
Well, maybe if the leaders join the caucus.
Well, that would be an interesting moment.
You know, I looked at your Twitter feed in preparing for this, and I see a lot of
retweeting the Pope.
Retweets of Pope Francis, tweets about the Save the Children Foundation and other efforts on behalf of women and children, I think particularly in the developing world. This is a real interest of yours.
Yeah, I all my life had said that women like me who went directly into the workforce after college had at some point in our lives the obligation to do what many of our mothers had done, which is, you know, work in the community and make a true contribution. And I had done the, you know, the PTA. I was president of the PTA. It's the worst job on earth.
And when you were covering Congress?
No, that was when I was living in Greece. But I was still in the PTA when I was covering Congress. But And I had done the journalistic things, the radio, TV, gallery, all of that stuff. But I had not really done anything in the community. And finally, I reached an age where I had to put my body where the rest of my body where my mouth was. And I started thinking about it, and I realized that my passion was children, obviously the future and all that. And it was certainly coming out of motherhood, now grandmotherhood. And I did my due diligence as a journalist and started looking around at organizations that really make a difference for children. And Save the Children just kept coming back. I was also very impressed with its gathering of data and its efficacy. And so it turned out that the chairman of the board at the time was Tom Murphy, who was my boss, and I didn't know that. And he's a wonderful human being. He had been head of ABC for years. And so I went to him and said, you know, I can help. And I had done a few events for him, but I said, I know what I can do is I can fill a room. And so he said, great, you know, I'll get back to you. And then they came to me and said, if you're going to do that, you should be on the board. And I said, fine. And so I've been involved with them this century and gone all over the world. Actually, one of my proudest moments, when people say, what are you proud of? Obviously, it's raising wonderful human beings. But the other is that I went from Aceh, Indonesia, where it was about 100 degrees a year after the tsunami, to witness that, and went directly from there to Pakistan immediately after an earthquake, where it was about 25 below, and in both cases had to be both, you know, camping out and at embassy events, and I did it all in carry-on.
So we can add that to
right. All
of the other stuff. Well, we're grateful for your efforts in all these ways and all the insight you've brought us.
So before that, let me just say again, first of all, Dave, thank you, and what a great treasure you have in having Dave do reporting here. But secondly, I really do mean thank you to you. What you do makes all the difference in the world and our ability to do what we do. So thank you, thank you, thank you.